Welcome to Healthy Brain, Happy Body, a podcast from the Northeast Region Biofeedback Society. I'm Dr. Saul Rosenthal, a health psychologist in the Boston area, and your host as we investigate the incredible connections between brain and body. Listeners, we are continuing our discussion of creativity and its relation to the mind and body. Kimaya Lakhamwasam is a doctoral student at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology in the MIT Media Lab. She's a neuroscientist and singer-songwriter who's investigating the impact of music and audio-based intervention on mental health. Kimaya was a 2023 MIT Presidential Fellow and a 2021 Harriet A. Shaw Fellow for Music Research. She's presented her research all over the world, and she joins us today. Kimaya, welcome to Healthy Brain, Happy Body.
Thanks so much for having me.
Absolutely. So I always like to start with an origin story. How did you come to bring together music and physiology and mental health?
Yeah, I actually became interested in neuroscience and psychology because I'm a musician. I played in bands and I was writing music all through high school. And when I was thinking about what to do next, what came next, the only real thing that I was interested in was music and why music was such an engaging art form, why it matters so much to people, why it's so central to the way that we perceive ourselves and think about the world. So those questions really drew me to study neuroscience and psychology. And from there, I did a little bit of a pivot away from this sort of combined study. I went to Wellesley College, and there's a really amazing neuroscience department there. So I was exposed to a lot of really interesting neuro and psych concepts I'd never even thought about before, looking at consciousness in anesthetized patients and thinking about brain-computer interfaces in the lab I worked in at MIT as an undergrad, which was Emory Brown's NSRL. Mm-hmm. And then when I was thinking about grad school, I was confronted with the fact that I had spent 4 years trying to force music into everything that I had done, whether that was, you know, papers in class or studies that we were running in the lab. And all of my mentors said, okay, well, this is something that really matters to you, that you really care about. So why not try to work at this intersection and see if you can make things work there? And that is how I wound up, very thankfully, at the Media Lab.
Mm. Can you tell us a little bit about it? I mean, many people have heard of the Media Lab, probably not just in this part of the world. But what's it like to be there and your involvement there and with the Opera of the Future?
Yeah, the Media Lab is a very diverse department. So we get our degrees in media arts and sciences, but that could mean any number of things. I do music and emotion research, but I have friends who are working with computer vision and modeling the evolution of the eye. I have friends who are working in wet labs. It's basically a place that has gotten a lot of people together from a lot of different backgrounds and with different degrees to see if we can all influence each other and think about research and science a little bit differently. It's a lot like an academic playground, and it's a very sort of self-driven, self-directed degree. So you've got to really feel motivated to believe that what you're doing makes sense in some mm-hmm. way, which I think is true of all academia, but we definitely feel it over at the lab. Yeah, I think I'm really lucky. I had some sort of background in AI machine learning, but I get to work with people who really care about the ethics of that kind of work. So there's this project out of the lab called the Jambot that is the project of Lancelot Blanchard and Perry Nasek, where they're actually thinking about ways that you can ethically have generative music where musicians will actually duet with themselves. And licensing and rights, it all belongs to the musicians. So that's kind of, there's music everywhere. There are people doing really cool things, but thinking about the ethical ways to do it. It's a very fun department to work in. I feel very lucky.
Mm. Now, the Jambot, I have heard of it. Is that out in the usable now? Is it out in the wild?
It is. They're getting there.
Okay. I'm sure.
there are a series of performances that are coming. They're working on, yeah, there's a lot of very cool things happening behind the scenes that I know that they're very excited to get out to the world.
Okay. And have you been working with the Opera of the Future?
Yes, I have been with Opera of the Future since 2021.
Mm-hmm. And what sort of work are you doing with them?
So the work that I do, it falls under the broad umbrella of music and emotion, but I've been looking at it in two parallel paths recently. So looking at the impact of live shows and concerts on our health and well-being. So looking at biometric data as well as self-report data. And I've been really lucky to collaborate with a bunch of really wonderful companies and organizations like Carnegie Hall or PixMob. We do the light up bracelets for big stadium shows because we all really want to get a sense of how these shows impact our physiology and our psychology, but also the ways that we can partner with big institutions and companies and artists to have these experiences serve as public health interventions. Mm. And the other part of what I do has been looking at the emotional resonance of AI-generated music as compared to human-composed music in functional contexts, because there's a lot of interest in using AI-generated music as a mental health intervention. But we don't totally know what it is about human music that impacts us optimally. So a big part of what I'm trying to do is look at claims that some folks might be making about the efficacy of this AI-generated music to sort of see if we can actually compare that to what we are working with, what we know works and what we know is ethical and important and a part of our society already, to see if this is something that has legs or something that we should even be looking at all.
Mm. So a lot of our listeners would be clinicians, and particularly those who are involved in mind-body work and physiology. So could you talk a little bit about the impact that music does have on physiology? What's some of the biometric findings you've had?
Yes. So the main biometric findings that I look at are sort of electrodermal activity, skin conductance, pulse rate, and then we look at temperature, movement. And what we've seen is that you will see spikes in electrodermal activity, spikes in pulse rate when people are excited and engaged in listening to music. That's something that we would expect. I think that seems pretty typical. I think the big question that we are trying to ask is how can we sustain this sort of physiological impact in a way that is positive and doesn't lead to overstimulation and anxiety induction. And I think that's the big question. Because when you look at big stadium shows or even smaller concerts in venues that people aren't familiar with, there are a lot of stimulating factors. So you've got the show that's happening as one data point, but then you also have the crowd, whether the crowd is moving and dancing, you've got weather, you've got venue, you've got lighting, you've got the temperature of the actual physical place. And then when you think about pop shows or rock shows, you've got intoxication level, you've got, you know, the group of people that people came with. So we're trying to get a sense of the full context surrounding somebody's experience and then a sense of the ways that you can map that context onto the physiological response, which is an absolute can of worms. I mean, it's so hard to control for all of these different factors. And it's one of the most exciting and most frustrating parts, I think, of this work.
I can imagine there's so many different variables involved.
Absolutely.
So you have looked at music, sound, and mental health and coined the term pharmamusicology. Could you tell us a little bit about that, what that term means and what are some of the mental health consequences?
Absolutely. Pharmamusicology is really all about clinically validating the use of music as a structured mental health intervention. It could be any number of things, but the way that I've been thinking about it recently is helping get people from point A to point B between therapy appointments, because there's a huge need for clinical mental health support, but from my understanding, clinicians are really overstretched, and there's a lot of ways that we on the research side can actually be supporting folks who are treating patients and working clinically. So that's a big part of what drew me to this, is giving clinicians tools to be able to have alternative ways of understanding their patients' emotional states between appointments, but also giving patients ways that are not replacements, but sort of tools to support them between appointments. And I'm so sorry, I'm forgetting the other part of your
question. Well, I'm curious about the, what are you finding, the impact on mental health? I know you've composed some pieces to be helpful with this. So what are you finding?
What we're finding is that even though we know that music impacts people's emotions as a baseline, the ways that specific pieces of music impact individuals is very diverse. So one example that I can give from my work is in 2023, I composed a piece about the pandemic. So I used the soundscape of the ICU, so the different alert tones of monitoring devices to sort of serve as the backbone of the piece. And I had a flautist and a violinist improvise using these different alert tones following the arc of a crashing COVID patient. This piece really came out of being in a medical family. My dad is a critical care anesthesiologist, and I was living back home with my parents over the pandemic and sort of seeing the toll of that experience on him and on family friends and just the weight that that carried. It was a way of paying tribute to that and also sort of coping with that that time in all of our lives. And what we did before the show was we collected a series of expectations from our audience. So we had, I believe it was a sample size of 20 who wanted to be a part of the survey. And they reported, I believe it was upwards of 13 different themes that they would expect to be covered in a piece about the pandemic. And they were all very diverse. And so we know from that small experiment that people come into a show with all these different expectations about how music impacts them. And it was one show, one place, a small community. This was Boston area people interested in weird experimental music. And they had all these different ideas of what this should be. Mm-hmm. And at the end of the show, we collected their reflections. And while, thankfully for me, people generally felt pretty positive about the piece, people took many, many, many different things away from the experience and different parts of it resonated from them. And this is an only 15-minute piece of music. So when you think about bigger shows or independent music listening, which is a huge way that people interact with music to modulate their own emotions, we need to think about these interventions as structures that have to be very flexible and very scalable. Because what serves as relaxing or cathartic for one person is not necessarily the case for another person. So when we think about an intervention, we need to make sure that it is able to flexibly grow alongside a person's music taste. So if there's a piece of music that is relaxing for me today, but then I get in my car to go to work and it plays over and over again in bumper to bumper traffic, I would find that music to be a bit more annoying than I did at the start. Mm-hmm. So we need to be able to accommodate for that in any form of musicological intervention that we would deploy.
I would imagine that there's also individual differences. So physiologic profiles, mm-hmm. people with different physiological profiles might respond differently to different types of music.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And that is something that I have not been able to look into specifically, but it's on my punch list of things that I want to look into in this PhD. Mm-hmm. The other part of it is the impact of cultural background. So there has been a really exciting growing interest in music psychology, looking at the impact of our early exposures to music and the ways that those different types of songs or maybe different scales, if we're looking at monolithic Eastern versus Western music, the way that that has a different impact on the ways that we respond to music emotionally, both structurally but also with self-report data. So that is something else that I'm really excited to start digging into a bit more. Mm.
So that's, okay, this is really interesting. So that's been, as you said, that's been self-report data, so no one's done like a developmental look at that?
There are people who are. Psyche Louie's group out of Northeastern has done really, really amazing developmental research with music. Mm. I do not have access to fMRI resources, so that is something that I'm limited by, but it's there's a really amazing music and health community in the Boston area. There's a lot of mm-hmm. a lot of really wonderful work happening mm-hmm. that I'm lucky to sort of either hear about or be tangential to, but it's, yeah, it's a very fun festival.
Okay. Well, when you think about composing music from the pharmamusicology perspective, what are some of the principles you're going to bring into your decisions?
Yeah, we have a baseline of work that has shown us how different elements of music impact the physiological and self-reported responses of a subset of participants and populations. So there is a sense that certain tempos and rhythms will have either, you know, elevated effects or more diminished effects on sort of participant activity. Maybe some things may be more anxiety inducing for some participants as compared to others. We also know that melodic nature plays a role in anxiety induction. I think that also dynamics, is all these different elements of music have very specific mapped effects, but we don't know the global scale of this. So a lot of work that I have seen, that's not to say that this is the case of all research, but a lot of work that I have seen has focused on very Western contexts. And so I have a pretty good sense of how different musical elements will impact listeners with Western backgrounds and trainings.
Mm-hmm.
Interestingly, a lot of musical concepts that Western listeners might find to be stressful are a part of very traditional Eastern music. Right. So whether that is more up-tempo drum beats or whether that is alternative rhythms. So there is a lot that could actually be counterintuitive for people raised in different contexts. So that is something that I consider when I'm making music is, you know, this is targeted at eliciting a specific type of emotion in a specific population, which is something that we have to acknowledge just based off of limitations of what is available to us right now. So with the piece that I wrote about the pandemic, we had a very sort of slow kind of melodic section with a bit of a build that went straight into the alert tones of mm-hmm. a ventilator. Mm-hmm. And that was jarring, and that I figured would impact anybody regardless of culture. When you're moving from something a bit softer and more sedate to something very, very loud and very, very sharp, that was a piece that I said, okay, well, I'm expecting that this will be something that makes people a bit more anxious. And we can hopefully take them down from that peak over the course of the piece. But it's sort of a microcosmic example of things that I would consider.
And I would imagine that it would be easier to make people anxious than to bring them down, because there's probably a lot more yes. variability in how to do that.
Absolutely.
Than
Absolutely.
Getting them there in the first place.
Yeah, and I think framing is actually very helpful. Mm-hmm. In this context, if you bring someone into an experience and you say, this is a well-being experience, this is meant to relax you, it primes them to think about or to identify the different parts of the experience that they would find relaxing for themselves.
Okay. So where in the last 10 minutes or so, I feel like you've laid out potential for sort of three lifetimes of research. But where are you planning on going with this next?
I really am passionate about this clinical validation element of all of this. Mm-hmm. I really love doing research, and I love how many amazing things I get to explore. But the thing that drew me to research in the first place was actually getting these interventions in the hands of the people that need them, both clinicians who would want to use them to help their patients, but also with patients who could really use the extra support. So I think for me, the big next step would be thinking about the ways that we can make sure any interventions that we create are tested and rigorous enough that we can confidently get them in the hands of clinicians to deploy to their patients. And the ways of approaching that, I think, like you said, there's so many different ways that this could happen. And I am thankfully solidly in the middle of my PhD, so I have a little time to think about the specific ways that I would like to approach that. But I think for me, the most exciting part of all of this is the real world applications of it, just working with folks in the music industry, working with clinicians, and having there be this really powerful synthesis that I know works that we can actually provide to the folks that need it the most.
So I'd like to take a little break here, and when we come back, I'd love to talk with you more about sort of the clinical implications. I also want to talk with you about AI, because of course that's the topic of the moment.
Kimaya and I will continue our conversation in the next episode, discussing the ways music can affect psychological functioning and the growing role of artificial intelligence in music and creativity. This is Healthy Brain, Happy Body. I'm your host, Dr. Saul Rosenthal. Our guide today was Kimaya Lekamwasam, a neuroscientist, singer-songwriter, and doctoral student in the Media Lab at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology. Subscribe to this podcast by clicking the Subscribe Here link or wherever you get your podcasts. If you enjoy Healthy Brain, Happy Body, please rate us and leave reviews at Apple Podcasts, YouTube, or wherever you get the podcast. Reviews help us reach more listeners, and that's more people who can learn about and benefit from biofeedback, neurofeedback, and other mind-body approaches to health. Also, let us know what you think by sending us email. Our address is healthybrain@nrbs.org. Healthy Brain, Happy Body is produced and edited by me. The theme music is Catch It by Coma Media. It is a production of the Northeast Region Biofeedback Society. Go to nrbs.org to find out more about the organization, including our trainings, monthly webinars, and yearly conference. All opinions expressed are those of our guests and not the NRBS. This podcast is not meant to replace advice from qualified healthcare providers. Healthy Brain, Happy Body is supported by the sponsors of NRBS and by the International Society for Neuroregulation and Research. Be sure to join us on our next episode as we continue to explore the keys to our well-being on Healthy Brain, Happy Body.